come to our attention that a mysterious force is loose somewhere in outer space.
Welcome to Talk Tank.
Hello, you have reached the Talk Tank, the official LC Entrepreneurs podcast where we delve into the minds of those who think, live, and breathe outside the box. My name is Jessica G, and I will be your host for today. Welcome to Bits and Bytes, our series dedicated to innovation and technology at the heart of society's change. By searching into the technology that drives transformation, we will meet the humans who revolutionize our lives bit by bit. During a global pandemic, the world lives in uncertainty. Today's guest addresses this uncertainty through her London-based company. Jiawei Li, a graduated PhD medicine student from UCL, is the founder and CEO of Tuli Health, a digital health platform catered to serving global citizens. Hear Jiawei's fascinating story of dropping everything as a prospective doctor to travel across China and begin her own startup. Don't miss out. At this point, Jiawei, thank you for coming onto the podcast, first of all. But we would have already introduced you briefly. But why don't you go ahead and introduce yourself a little further to our audience? Who are you? What is Tuli Health?
Okay, that's great. Thanks. Thank you for having me here today. So I'm Jiawei. I'm the founder and CEO of Tuli Health. We're building the global healthcare platform that breaks down cultural and language barriers. So we allow patients to get instant access to private appointments and testings, which can be remote and on demand and with an interpreter if you need to.
Wow. Okay. So that's quite an ambitious, you know, project that you guys are doing. How did something, such a big concept, you know, come about? How did Tuli Health get its start?
Well, it's actually quite personal. For myself, I mean, I was born and grew up in China and came to the UK when I was 12. So I always call myself as Generation 1.5, who's heavily influenced by the Asian culture and also the British culture. So in fact, I'm building something that people like me would use and would need.
I see. So before Tuli Health really come about, it was kind of formerly known as Smart Lingual. So just for our listeners who want to know a little bit about the history before Tuli Health came, you know, what was Smart Lingual and why did it change?
Yeah, so we started off being called Smart Lingual, that we were building a medical translation platform. So the goal was to break down the language barriers in healthcare settings. And we were helping a lot of patients, mainly Chinese patients, who have language difficulties and don't know how to access healthcare in the UK. And the reason I started that was because, you know, as I was a medical student and also a PhD student, I also worked as a medical interpreter and translator. So I helped a lot of patients to solve their problems when they go and see a doctor. And I also helped a lot of refugees. And that's when I actually saw there's a huge gap in helping people with their language difficulties. So initially we started off as just providing that medical translation service and enabled by AI. And then I realized the pain points are much greater than just translation and just language. It's more of a how easily the healthcare can be accessed. And that's when we pivoted from Smart Lingual to Tuli Health.
I see. So you focused more on like localizing healthcare for ethnic minorities, right?
Yeah, that's correct. Because that's one thing we have observed. Although, you know, the NHS system in the UK is amazing and it's free at the point of care, but it doesn't actually cater for all the needs of everyone. There are people, for example, I mean, obviously I understand the most from the Chinese community, but when I spoke to a lot of other ethnic minorities, people from different countries, how they use the healthcare services is so different. For example, someone who's Italian, they still feel more comfortable speaking to an Italian doctor than speaking to a British doctor.
I see. So it's not really something where, you know, people, if, for example, the Italian patient, they wouldn't use Tuli Health as like a substitute, but more as a complement, like
as you said, to like the NHS. So, you know, what type of other services does Tuli Health provide to make it a complement for, you know, what's already out there in terms of healthcare?
Well, so it's exactly what you said. We are complementing the existing healthcare system. So NHS, it tries to cater for everyone and majority of the population. But there are some people, they have a little bit more disposable income. And what they need is actually to access the healthcare services quickly and immediately, or maybe around the clock, 24/7. And also they might need an interpreter in the middle, or they might have other special needs. That's the bit that we cover, and we try to fill in that gap.
I see. And so, as you said before as well, it does really help people who belong to special minorities, you know, with circumstances like their language and maybe cultural barriers, and they just feel, as you said, genuinely like more comfortable with certain doctors and, you know, professionals. But if you were to look at, you know, aside from like those differences, but if you were to look at like the market in the UK for healthcare services as opposed to like China and other countries, do you see any like big differences or any patterns maybe that people don't really know about or think about?
Yeah, there's definitely a lot of differences. I mean, for example, in the UK, the NHS is free at the point of care. But because it's free and it caters to everyone, so it kind of try to prioritize certain cases over others. But with, say, the Chinese community who live in the UK, and their behavior tends to be that if they want to access certain healthcare, they want it immediately. They want it now. And also that in the UK, we have the primary healthcare, secondary healthcare, and also the tertiary. So all your care tends to be looked after at the GP level. Whereas in China, there are no GPs. People tend to go directly to the specialist and make appointment with specialist doctors then. So what we're doing here is we're actually localizing the healthcare access to allow this group of people, the Chinese people, if they want to access the healthcare immediately, they can, and they have that option if they want to.
That's really interesting. I didn't know that there were, I mean, this many differences in healthcare. But, you know, speaking about China, I remember that in 2018, you wrote about, I think, in a blog post, but you traveled to China. And in less than, you know, 2 weeks, you were visiting like 12 hospitals, public and private. You were speaking to patients and other professionals. So that's quite, you know, a big, I guess you could even say life-changing trip. But what did you see on your trip there? And, you know, was there a purpose to your trip? Did you think you fulfilled your purpose and stuff like that?
Yeah, so the purpose of the trip was to really understand the healthcare system in China a bit more. So what I initially wanted to build is a global, well, actually, I wouldn't say initially, I still want to build, is the global healthcare platform that connects everyone, right? And then there's no border, there's no cultural barriers, no language barriers. So I went to China, where being in a blank canvas, even though I grew up in China, I'm Chinese myself, but majority of my life is still spent in the UK. And also China has changed so much in the last 10 to 20 years. So I went there to actually see, okay, how does China do, what is China doing with the healthcare? I went, literally everywhere from north to south, west to east, around different cities. And I visited different hospitals and talked to hospital directors as well. And I actually found that currently the Chinese healthcare system has been modeled upon the US system. And it relies a bit between the kind of the private insurance and also the public insurance, well, the state insurance. But now they've actually found that that's been insufficient. And then now China's healthcare system is going into the next stage and it's trying to reform. And China is actually eager to learn what kind of system the UK actually utilizes. Because in fact, like NHS is a very successful system. And it still try to, well, provide healthcare for everyone. In China, there is no primary healthcare. And China has identified that there's a gap. But then what happens is like a lot of Chinese patients, when they are ill, they tend to rush to what we call Sanjia, or the tier three hospitals. And then those hospitals tend to be overwhelmed with loads of patients. And in fact, 95% of the conditions could be solved at a primary level. So now China, well, not everywhere, but they have pilot cities. I mean, for one, in Shanghai, Shanghai is trying to absorb some of the experience from the UK and trying to establish a primary healthcare system. And in the process, actually try to train up more general physicians and not just specialists.
Okay, so, well, they're really learning a lot from the UK and our healthcare system. Moving on to something that's also really exciting for Thule Health. So you guys are currently in the process of developing, I don't know how far you've gotten, but developing an app and maybe a PWA. Why don't you tell our listeners a bit about what a PWA is and how this whole development process is going and where you want to take this app with Thule Health?
Okay, so it's quite interesting you mentioned about the app, because app can be different things by definition. I mean, when other people talk about app, they tend to mean native apps, which you can either find on the Apple Store or the Android Store or Huawei Store. Whereas with our team, because we're a startup and quite lean, we took on an active approach that we decided not to actually develop a native app, because that takes a lot of developing time. But instead, we opted for what we call a progressive web app. We just call it a web app, obviously. So which means it can be shown on the desktop browser. And when it's on the mobile phone, it actually shrinks almost like an app. I mean, you can tell the tiny differences between the native app and also the PWA in terms of the user experience. So it's not that we develop one phase and then release it, but it's actually, it's a very agile approach that every time we develop, we can deploy it immediately across all platforms, whether it's a web browser or from in the App Store. In fact, I think the concept of PWA was first brought out by Steve Jobs, and then that's in a way that was the ideal situation, an ideal way of what app should be like. So in a way, we're actually quite at the forefront of it. I mean, some people still think native apps are necessary because of better user experience, but it just myself and also my co-founder Jialu took the stance that we would like to go for the PWA.
Okay, and that makes sense. And especially with COVID, with people, you know, you don't have the luxury of going out and you know, endorsing in certain services. Obviously, making an app, doing something from your phone or the comfort of your laptop is, it's practical. But I mean, you know, COVID and obviously you're in like a healthcare business. So those two are, you know, very linked strongly together. But how has COVID, I guess, affected business for Thule Health? Not just business, but also has it brought anything new to the table, I guess, just in general for Thule Health?
So when it happened last year, when it first happened last year in China, we were in the UK and UK wasn't affected. And we were actually looking at the Chinese problem, the problems in China, more like an outsider. And then we actually never anticipated that COVID would also affect the UK and in fact rest of the world. And when it actually happened in March, we were actually in the middle of fundraise, and then I think the whole investment scene kind of took a bit of a pause and took a bit of a standstill, because we were in the middle of fundraise, and obviously it did affect us. And the way we did it in the middle, I actually think, okay, what are we going to do? Are we still going to continue our fundraise? What's the next step? And especially, we were doing a lot of cross-border healthcare access as well, and basically catering for Chinese patients who are in China and coming to the UK for medical treatments or second opinion. And obviously that really, because close of the borders, it really affected us. And it did actually affect us for a couple of months because we didn't know really what to do. But luckily, I think we were really quick and agile to realize what we could have done. So we shifted our focus from targeting at clients based in China to clients in the UK, because we found, in fact, it's the access of healthcare services, everyone has that problem, international students and expats in the UK who need that help. Yeah, and then what we did is that we stopped looking for external investment, and we actually looked within, basically saying, with our existing resource, what could we do? And obviously, I leveraged on my understanding, on my connections in China, and actually started helping some like medical companies on how to procure a medical device and medical PPEs. I was offering that a bit of a consulting service, which actually kept us afloat for a while. And then we actually then just quickly developed and added the private remote GP service specifically for Chinese community in the UK. And in fact, now, well, it's been a year now since the first event, like COVID event happened, we actually has developed a lot. And in fact, we're in a position that even without external funding, we're growing.
Wow. Okay. So, you know, some hardships in the beginning with obviously the whole investing was getting, you know, more difficult to acquire. But now, hopefully, yeah, as you said, it's getting better. Why don't you tell us about what this whole remote GP service is?
Yeah, it's actually quite simple. So the idea first came about, it was because a lot of Chinese students and Chinese expats approached us when COVID happened. They were like, I need this and I don't want to physically see a doctor because I don't want to have the risk of getting COVID. And they came to me. And because I've been quite active among the Chinese community and because of my medical background, so naturally I became a little bit of a kind of a key opinion leader. So that's when I realized actually, you know, these remote medical consultations, it's not just for people who are in China and trying to get healthcare services in the UK, but in fact it's for everyone. And that's when we started partnering up with London Doctors Clinic. And embedded that service into what we have. And now we're actually working directly with private GPs as well. And in fact, we've been getting Chinese private GPs or private GPs trained in the UK who can speak Mandarin, so on board with us. So our community can access the healthcare services and advice they need.
Wow. And in those services, does it also include any form of like COVID testing or is it just mainly like consulting?
Recently, we have been starting offering COVID tests, COVID-19 tests for traveling purposes. And the aim of that is to help Chinese students and Chinese people living in the UK to get back to China safely. And in fact, to date, we have tested, over 500 people.
Wow. Okay. That's great. And I think, you know, getting more active in the, you know, the whole Chinese community in London and the UK definitely must have helped you there. But, you know, kind of going back, you've told us about all this great stuff that's been happening. But one thing that I've noticed, which applies no matter what, is that, you know, you started your own company. It's still kind of in the startup process. And you're basically your own entrepreneur. But you're doing this all as someone who's relatively young. You do have your degree, all of your qualifications and stuff, but some people could argue compared to like someone who's, you know, a senior in medical care that you're young, you know, you're maybe less experienced, but also most importantly, you're a female. And, you know, in terms of just entrepreneurship in general and business, it's quite rare to find, you know, females who are starting their own thing. So doing all this great stuff and even being active in the Chinese community, there must have been, you know, times where being a female might have been a disadvantage, especially, you know, as an ethnic minority. But could you just kind of tell us what is it really like being a female entrepreneur?
Okay, so your question is really good and touched on three different points. So one is gender, second is age, and the third is ethnicity. So the first bit, gender, you know, as a woman and being a female entrepreneur, and it's not easy. Mm. It has been a lot better than it used to be. People are more open to the idea of having a woman entrepreneur or woman founder and CEO. But still, until this day, I see different startups and different businesses. I still see more men than women. Mm. And then as a woman, we still tend to have the stereotypical image that you're supposed to be very nice, very friendly, yeah. And then you might not be so tough in making business decisions. Then obviously, that's a misconception. And then, in fact, I've been finding a lot of women entrepreneurs or women CEOs, they work very, very hard. And a lot of my partners in partnering businesses, and I find that the key people in it and where we really make progress are female entrepreneurs and female business women. Every time I'm actually in a bit of a problem that I needed someone to help me, and in the middle of the night, I pick up my phone to call someone or call a business, it has always been a woman that picks up the phone. So I think, well, in the future, so women, we need to give us more credit that we are performing very well. And also as in general, as a community, you know, the startup community, is that we should all give women entrepreneurs a bit more credit. And the second point that you touched on is ethnicity. And that actually links with the gender quite closely, because being an ethnic minority, and we again, we have some kind of stereotypical image that especially, I mean, I don't know for others, but for Chinese, a Chinese woman supposed to be petite, very gentle, very nice, always smiling. And in fact, just because we're friendly and smiling and we're small, and does not mean we're unable to make decisions. In fact, when things come around and we know, and in fact, I find myself is that I know what to do. I can make tough decisions. But sadly, some people still have the old idea of what we're supposed to be. I mean, especially, that's another thing I experienced when I went to China for the field trip to understand about the business and different things. And because I was young, I was a woman, and a lot of businessmen in China who tend to be around 50s plus men, and they saw I was the secretary or the interpreter of the group. But okay, I understood, I mean, and I understood that how they feel, but at the same time, I actually really showed that actually it doesn't matter. Like, it doesn't matter what you think of me, but I was a decision maker. And then the third part, I think you touched on, was about age, right?
Yes.
Yeah, in fact, a lot. If you look at it, a lot of healthcare businesses, when they first started, they tend to be founded by someone probably 40 plus, have years of experience in medicine or in healthcare. And whereas here's me, basically a new graduate with not much experience in the area. But I think the age serves as both advantage and disadvantage. Yeah, sure, I have less experience than someone who's more senior. I probably have less connections. But the advantage of being young is that my brain is quite free and flexible. I can think outside the box. I don't draw into what's already there. And my inspiration can be from anywhere. And I'm definitely very energetic that I can I have quick on my feet to try out different things. I mean, I am humble enough to admit that I don't have enough experience in the healthcare sector, but that's when I'm willing to learn. I'm willing to actually have an open mind to actually see what's already there. And I'm actually humble enough to get other advisors who are way more experienced to actually teach me what I don't know. So I definitely do not think the three things you mentioned, gender, ethnicity, and age, are a problem. And in fact, that's the stereotypical images I'm trying to break as well.
That's great. I think how you kind of turn three disadvantages on their head and you earn people's respect and you turn these disadvantages into things you could even use as an advantage. I think that's a great way to deal with the circumstances you were given. And that's something you should be proud of. But, you know, I mean, that's great to hear. And I think for people who are out there listening, especially a lot of our listeners are usually like LSE students. And a lot of people they may want to take a traditional route and go and do something, you know, in finance, or they want to just go into a corporate job. But people who also have their own ideas and want to start something new and who probably might also have some of these so-called disadvantages, I think hearing this would definitely help them understand that, you know, it's not really a problem. But, you know, going back to kind of the roots of things and the roots of Thule Health, obviously there's probably quite an abundance of things that made you want to start Thule Health, you know, including that field trip that you mentioned before. But do you think there was like a defining moment, or even you can tell us about the collection of moments that made you realize that this was what you wanted to do, as opposed to, you know, going down the traditional route of graduating from medicine and becoming a doctor?
Well, there were many moments, right? There was not a single defining moment that shifted my mentality from one to the other. I mean, when I first started off, it was more like a pet project. We started just for fun. And then you kind of just go with the flow. And it ended up being where you are. I mean, last year when there were the COVID situation, loads of uncertainties, there were in fact many points I thought about giving up and thought about, I mean, that's it, like, let's wrap it up. But I kind of just stuck with it. And I feel that it's just more, as long as you continue and you then get customers come to you with problems, and then you solve that problem, and you feel like you're really providing something of value. And then it's when that moment happens, and every time you become more sure of the situation, and every time it become more certain, and this is the right thing to do.
So it's rewarding. But you had such a great background with education, I would say, and I saw that you did a lot of research in medicine, and, you know, you went and you got your bachelor's in medicine, you got your PhD in medicine, and people obviously around you, probably your family and friends, they all kind of, and your classmates too, probably expected that you'd either go into like medical research or you'd become a doctor. So to kind of just drop everything and, you know, not even pursue this as like a little side project that you have as kind of a hobby, but doing this full time as the CEO and founder of Thule Health, like, how was that?
Well, dropping everything to pursue Thule Health wasn't really that difficult for me, because inside I felt that was the right thing to do. But from my family and friends, their reactions, I mean, you probably can't even anticipate and predict, especially from Asian parents. So what they want is that they always want children to have a successful career, a stable career, right? Where you're respected. I mean, being a doctor is very respectful.
Yeah.
So in my mom's, in my mother's head, is that I'll be a doctor. I'll done my PhD, then hopefully I'll be a clinical lecturer. So it'll be a very comfortable job, respected, and then I have children and then live a very good life, right? That's like the ideal way, and especially I'm a girl, okay? Asian parents don't really expect that much even though my mom she's quite a strong woman, but it's still the same, you know? They want their children to have what they think, an easy life. So when I first told her that I wanted to drop medicine and drop being a doctor, and actually any possibility of being a lecturer, but to pursue business, I mean, I didn't think she was against it, but she was definitely not, like, I'm 100% supportive of it. She was like, you do what you want to do if it makes you happy. And in fact, in her back of mind, she probably thinks that maybe I'll take it out for fun for a couple of years and then come back being a doctor. So that's definitely from her. And then she saw how I worked, how I was really busy. And there were times I don't have even enough time to eat food or sit down. And she fell for it. And she definitely still feels that it might have been better that if I stayed being a doctor or being a lecturer or something.
Mm-hmm.
So, but now she's more coming around to it, because I keep telling her, I said, it's not really about the prestige, it's not about the money, it's about that I'm doing something I enjoy, I'm passionate about.
Yeah.
And she's coming around to it a bit more now.
That's great. I mean, her seeing that passion and that drive, obviously, yeah. Because I can especially, like, understand, and I know there's that whole, you know, stereotype that people always joke around, you know, if you're from like a Chinese family, you know, go to school, grow up, become a doctor or a lawyer. And in some ways, like, okay, that's a little bit racist, but that's also a little bit true. But also, especially as a woman, like, even my mom told me that, you know, grow up and just become like an English teacher or something. And when I was trying to take, you know, chemistry and physics courses in high school, even though I knew that I wanted to, like, go into some type of business or political program, she was like, why are you taking these? Why are you making it harder for yourself? You're not a guy. Just marry a rich doctor and, like, live as an English teacher and life will be great. But
yes, that's right.
It's exactly.
You know, marry well.
Yeah, marry well. If you're the girl, marry someone smarter and richer than you and life will be smooth. But I mean, it's not exciting if you're doing that. And I think you're doing something that's a little more fulfilling, and it strays from the norm, so maybe you don't get the best reaction all the time, but at least you could be proud that you're doing something that, you know, you're not, if you chose to go a traditional route, you might have still had a little bit of lingering regret.
Yeah. I mean, but then there are times also other people as well, they're coming to me and thinking, why you're not being a doctor? You know, you get the prestige and the money. Well, yeah. Actually, and I'm like, it's really not about that.
Exactly. That's good. That's a good way of thinking. You know, going into startup, there's a very high chance that, you know, you can fail. You can go plummeting down, lose everything, and then some people would even say it's a waste of time. But a lot of people also go into it, I would say, a little bit naive, thinking that, you know, as long as I have a good idea and I'm good with business, I'm good with words, you know, I can make this huge thing, maybe even make a unicorn startup. But I remember that you kind of talked about before with me outside of the podcast about this article called Forget Unicorns. We should try and create camel startups instead. And I read a little bit of the article. I found it interesting. Why don't you tell us a little bit about how you kind of use what was said in that article about becoming more resistant, resilient, and focusing on the strengths of a startup as a camel, and how you kind of use that in Thule Health, and if you agree with that view.
Yeah, I mean, I read that article, I think around the same time pandemic really affected Europe. It really started to affect the investment circle and also the startup circle, because there were just so many uncertainties, and we are experiencing something that no one really experienced before. At this scale, really. And then that's when I actually started thinking. I said, you know, when you start a business and start a startup, everyone wants to be the next Mark Zuckerberg, or they want to be the next Google or something. But in fact, those are rare. I mean, obviously there was a lot of hard work going into it, timing. And also there is a bit of a luck in it. And not every single business can be unicorn. And in fact, you don't have to be a unicorn to be classified as a successful business. And what we need, when time is good and when there is enough investment going around, right, then you might want to raise more funding. But then we also need to think about very carefully, is that, is your business valid even without external funding? Can you be resilient enough that you can go through all events, mm-hmm. right? And if you look at unicorn, that's like a fantasy creature, yeah. right? But you then need to look at a camel, that's real. Mm. And it goes through desert. It goes through the toughest condition, and it's still there. And that's, in a way, what we aim and aspire to be. Is that we want to be the business that can actually ride through all events and all adverse events and still come out to be fine. And that's why I also started thinking, instead of looking outwards, looking at external investment, but looking inwards, what mm-hmm. we have, what resource we can leverage on. And in fact, a lot of startups, they pursue investment and they pursue the valuation as the key metrics. Almost like, oh, I raised 1 million today, or I raised 10 million the other day. But instead of looking at that, we should actually look at it. It's like, what values have we provided for the customers? What problems have we solved? Mm. We should not use valuation, like fund that's raised, as a metric, but more as how many customers we served and how many problems we solved as a successful metric.
And especially with the article saying going through harsher conditions, for example, like some businesses that struggled when a pandemic hit them, or businesses that go through financial crises, you have all of these things that could happen to a business. And if you're not resilient and you kind of just have this whole very, I guess, overly optimistic view that we're just going to focus on the numbers, the investment, the money, not on the numbers based on, you know, consumer satisfaction and the actual product we're developing, that it's more prone to failure. And people who are kind of blindsided by this whole idea and this fantasy with this whole unicorn startup idea, it's not realistic, as you said, as like a camel is a real creature, you could say, as an analogy. But okay, this was a really interesting discussion, and I'm glad that we got to know, you know, more about you, Thule Health, the start, problems and the successes and everything that you faced. But we're going to move on to a new section called Real Talk, and we ask everyone from all walks of life that we interview these questions. They're just two signature questions, so these are quite heavy questions, so don't feel pressured to, you know, come out with an answer right away. But the first question is, if you could change one thing about society, what would it be?
That's a very tricky question.
It is, yes.
Because you're always like, okay, there's so many things to change about the society, or there's so many things you want to do. It's difficult to find what you actually want to do. And if you actually just talk about one thing in society, I'll give you a bit of my view on this. I would actually just change myself and actually improve myself because I'm part of this society. And if I say I want to change one thing, like cure AIDS or something, that's very unrealistic. It still has a long journey, a long way to go. But if I can just change and improve myself, and my positive contribution hopefully will give the positive contribution to the society. So if I ask me, I just improve myself and make myself a better person.
I think that's a good, honest answer, you know, as simple as it may sound. But I think people who, a lot of interviews that we have who, when we ask this question, I guess they kind of think of it like a genie who grants them a wish, and they just say, okay, you know, what would you do? Change this one big thing, like you said, curing AIDS in society. But you're taking it from a more realistic perspective, something that you could actually do, like starting today, right now, is change yourself. So yeah, I think it's a very honest answer to give. But our next question, what is an unconventional, you know, truth or fact, or something that you did that you believe helped you achieve your success?
Do the small things right. Would you say it's conventional or unconventional? But I think a lot of time people ignore how little things really matter. In fact, it's like the tiny things can actually can have a huge influence and a huge effect on the end results. So just do the small things right.
Those were two very interesting and I would say very honest responses to Real Talk. Thank you for answering those questions. And, you know, overall, thank you for your time and for talking to us about your start in the remote medical service industry and, you know, even how COVID has affected it. But to wrap up, you know, our interview today, we just have one final question to ask you. And it's, if you could invite anyone in the world you want for a podcast interview, if, say, for example, you had your own podcast, maybe a Thule Health podcast, I don't know, or you are a member of our team and you were on this podcast. Either way, in a hypothetical situation, you could invite anyone in the world for a podcast interview. They could even be dead, live, fictional, or very real. But who would you invite and why?
Well, I would love to invite a lot of people, actually, to actually interview them and learn about their story. I mean, one, I would invite Marcus Aurelius, but anyway, I don't think he would ever accept the invitation, even if he's alive. But, okay, so I would probably invite Tao Hua Bi, you know, the founder of Lao Gan Ma, who single-handedly made the chili jam or the chili oil into such a successful business. And the reason I wanted to invite her is that she wasn't actually educated, and she was just, I think, over 40 and with her children and built her business from ground up. And she was saying about how at the beginning she was like chopping chili just with the cleaver and chopping board every day. And then the chili, how the chili actually affected her hand, and then it just stained it so much. But just with her sheer resilience and hard work, and she started from just chopping chili to now making this chili oil, chili jam, like literally famous and distributed around the whole world. And in fact, I find that incredibly inspirational, and actually shows no matter where you're from, whether you're educated or not, but with hard work and resilience and time, you could become something.
I think that's a great message and a great person to select. I know it's a common theme in our podcast. We haven't really interviewed that many people who are Chinese. And also to give like an answer like that, I mean, especially to our Chinese listeners who are probably more familiar, but even if you aren't Chinese, I mean, Lao Gan Ma is a, like a, as she said, a spicy chili, I guess, oil, you could say, and people use it as like a sauce, a seasoning, but they sell it everywhere now. It's not just in, you know, the Chinese, Chinatown, Chinese supermarkets. I've even seen it like at Sainsbury's recently, which is kind of funny, Sainsbury's Expresses. So yeah, she has a really inspiring story and I'm glad you picked her.
And in fact, you know, what was most interesting is that Lao Ganma, the brand, is hardly doing any marketing.
Yeah, that's true. Actually, didn't think about that until you mentioned it. Thank you so much for coming on and also answering my questions so well. Thank you so much, Jiawei. It was a pleasure to talk to you.
Thank you. Thank you for having me here. And I do hope you invite more ethnic minority
founders. I hope so too. I hope so too. I will start reaching out to more, for sure.
Thanks for tuning in. See you next week and leave your message after the beep.